Chapter 17. Gracewood Institute, the private mental hospital where I spent the next 7 years of my life, faces Bellevue Avenue in Newport, Rhode Island, and turns its back on the Atlantic Ocean. From the well-traveled road, only the glorious granite mansion is visible, but the driveway forks around the main house and leads from either side to the two unassuming brick buildings that house the wards. A 12-foot cyclone fence borders the rear of Gracewood. Behind it are wild blueberry bushes, Newport's cliff walk, the cliffs themselves, the sea. I was an inpatient at Gracewood for the first 4 years after my encounter with the Wellfleet whale, an outpatient for the next three. I kept no diaries during that time to chronicle the thousands of hours I must have lost to tranquilizers and television, so my recollections are vivid, but gap-ridden. I remember fragments of the worst nights, the detached sound of my own shrieking as they held me down for forced injections, those quick jabs of pain when the needle broke through my skin, violated me like Jack. I recall how I sometimes doled out progress to them, then snatched it back again. One Saturday morning I capped off a good week by burning the insides of my thighs with a lighted cigarette. Their campaign to get me into the recreation room ended in my playing a game of Monopoly, then biting my hand hard enough to require inside stitches. Like the whale herself, my memories of Gracewood have become for me a corpse I'm obliged to carry. Sometimes it occupies the passenger seat in the car during long, quiet drives. Sometimes it lies beside me in bed, on nights when I can't sleep, or on nights when I can. The corpse is either benign or dangerous. It has the gift of speech. "You're a beautiful person, Dolores," Dr. Shaw told me the very first day I sat across from him, locked in my fat and self-hatred. "Yeah, right, I'm Miss Universe," I snapped back. "I won it in the swimsuit competition." He was the beautiful one, with his lion's mane of hair, that white turtleneck set against his tan skin. You could tell he was the outdoorsy cliff-walker type when he wasn't stuck inside with us wackos. He kept his office window cracked open to the thump of the ocean. Sometimes I'd look down from his green eyes to his thick, ringless fingers to the straw still stuck in the lacings of his earth shoes. In those early sessions, Dr. Shaw always leaned toward me, recliner to recliner, and smiled. "If you will only visualize your own beauty," he promised me that first day, "you can make it real." Dr. Shaw was my third psychotherapist at Gracewood. My first, Dr. Nettler, parted his hair just above his ear and plastered the long remaining strands over his bald spot. He had a little potbelly and stuttered so badly I spent half my time waiting for him to give birth to the syllables he eventually shaped into questions about my father's leaving and my mother's death. Questions I refused to answer. During our months and months of getting nowhere together, I drew my power from stubborn silence. Dr. Nettler's power came in the form of orders to the exasperated nurses and aides to take away my cigarette privileges, up my dosages, safety coat me whenever I got out of hand. Another of my Gracewood memories, the sour smell of that straitjacket, the futility of pulling against it. They thought I might cooperate better with Dr. Pragnesh, an Indian doctor, a woman. She had perpetual garlic breath and called Jack Mr. Spite, as if he was someone we were required to respect. "What do you think attracted you to Mr. Spite in the first place?" she asked in her squashed little accent. "I have no idea. Why is your hair so greasy all the time?" "What is all this belligerence for? Protection?" "What's that dot on your forehead for? Target practice?" It was Geneva Sweet who paid all my bills at the private hospital she'd flown east to select personally for me. Grandma had at first objected to the financial arrangement. This fairy godmother approach to making me sane. But Geneva had sat down in Grandma's parlor and pointed out that she and Irv were comfortable, that God had never given her a daughter of her own to provide for, that making me well was something she wanted to do for Bernice, God rest her soul. It was Geneva, too, who had led that Cape Cod shore patrolman to the Wellfleet beach for my belated rescue. After I'd phoned her from the motel and sung, "The worms go in, the worms go out," she'd fretted and paced, then telephoned Grandma, who, in turn, picked up the receiver and dialed Hooton Hall and the Rhode Island State Police. When you said over the phone that you were staying at a town where whales were dying, it was a clue. A long-distance cry for help, Geneva told me the first time we sat face to face. At least, that's what my therapist told me. She had rich lady looks, blonde-tinted hair pulled back in a knot, icy pink lipstick and matching nails, moisturized skin. I let her believe she'd rescued me. Kept it a secret that I'd tried death before that patrolman ever arrived, that I'd swum down and met that whale eye to eye. Gracewood put on the dog for rich visitors. When Geneva flew in at Christmas time, I was driven up to the mansion to see her. We sat on tan leather sofas in the festive solarium, Geneva balancing a cup of eggnog on her lap and calling attention to the lovely falling snow, the charming antique ornaments on the tree, and all that I should be thankful for. Grandma visited me back in the ward every Tuesday afternoon from 2 to 3:30. Gracewood was an $11 cab ride from Easterly. She came by cab, she said, because she didn't want to trouble Mrs. Mumphy's daughter during the week. The real reason was that she had kept my craziness a secret. Poor Grandma. First a daughter in the state hospital, then me at Gracewood. She kept her coat on during visits and held onto her purse strap, her eyes jumping nervously from Mrs. Ropiek's drool to old Lady DiPolito's peculiar attire. Flannel pajamas, fur-trimmed nightgown, high-cut sneakers. But Gracewood spared even Grandma the worst of it. The weekend aide who elbowed you hard if you didn't obey him fast enough. Manny the masturbator. Lillian, who picked her nose and wiped it on the wall, or who shit her pants for spite. "But you're basically happy here?" Geneva asked me when she visited again the following summer, phrasing it both as a question and the answer she wanted me to give. This time we were seated in Gracewood's spacious front yard on iron lattice lawn chairs, while gardeners primped at the color-coordinated petunia beds, and the Atlantic rumbled behind us. My hand was still bandaged from the week before, when I'd bitten it. "Basically, you're happy? You feel you're making progress." My reply was, as always, a snort of contempt, a drag on my cigarette. Geneva hugged me at the end of each visit, a mannequin's embrace that let you know she was nobody's mother. Dr. Shaw and I began our work together in the winter of 1971. I'll admit it, when I recall Dr. Shaw, it's with an impish memory that may or may not be playing tricks. I remember him as both my fool and my magician, the gullible idiot from whom I withheld information, and the powerful wizard who evoked secrets I'd kept even from myself. More often than not, Dr. Shaw's voice is the voice of the corpse. "How is Dolores Price this beautiful morning?" he asked me at the beginning of our first session. "She's fine. How's Dr. Quack Quack?" I answered, blowing a throatful of smoke in the direction of his "thank you for not smoking" sign. "Dr. Quack Quack? Why am I Dr. Quack Quack?" "You're all Dr. Quack Quacks here. You're all the same." "Several of my colleagues might debate you on that statement," he said, smiling. "What do you mean?" Well, let's just say that I'm a bit of a maverick.
Which one, Bart or Britt?
Excuse me? You could tell he was one of those wholesome types that never watched TV.
Nothing, I said. Just forget it.
He nodded, closed his eyes, and smiled at the beautiful version of me he claimed he saw. In our earliest sessions, all that shut-eyed smiling of Dr. Shaw's gave me the creeps. But he was so hopped up on visualization, saw a better me so emphatically, that he made me curious about the Dolores who existed behind his eyelids. Visualization was how I lost the weight. Not all of it, but enough so that people passing me just ignored another fat girl rather than gaping at a freak. "You've dropped another 7 pounds, I see," Dr. Shaw would say, smiling at my weekly report. "You know why you're slimming down, don't you?"
"No, why?"
It was better to let him tell you what you were thinking, rather than wasting time having him correct you. "Because you're beginning to conceptualize the beautiful person you really are. You're becoming the young woman you deserve to be."
"Oh," I said, "yeah."
After 6 months with Dr. Shaw, I could shove both hands down between my stomach and the waist of my jeans and flap my wrists in the space I made. I'm not going to say that didn't feel good. But I wasn't visualizing some beauty contest version of myself. I was seeing mold. That was how I did it. The cafeteria servers would cut me a square of shepherd's pie, a block of macaroni and cheese, a wedge of cream pie, enough food so that I'd have to heft, not just carry, my tray. Everyone at Gracewood was pale and flabby, exhausted from all that starch and trank. I'd plunk my meal down at one of the long tables and close my eyes like Dr. Shaw. When I opened them again, I'd picture the top surfaces going bad. I could make mold take hold of anything in front of me. Canned fruit cocktail, the surface of soup. It was a skill I got good at. I'd make it sprout in a corner of whatever was on my plate, then network it out, thicken it into a furry blue rug over whatever I was supposed to chew and swallow.
"She's gagging again," Mrs. DiPolito would always complain. "How are we supposed to eat our dinner with her gagging all the time?"
As if it was attractive to watch her eat scrambled eggs without her top teeth. As if that was appetizing. I never told Dr. Shaw about the mold. I let him believe he was helping me visualize some beautiful Dolores. After I got to know him, I didn't want to disillusion him. He walked a pretty thin line. As I began to drop weight, I began, as well, to drop my cattle prod of hostility whenever Dr. Shaw closed his office door. Our first major project was my night at Dottie's apartment. I took him through the particulars, then asked him outright.
"It means I'm gay, right?"
Dr. Shaw made his face a question. "Tell me again what you were thinking about during the encounter."
"Do you mean the part about me looking at the fish, or the part about Larry and Ruth?"
"I mean, what was going through your mind as she was bringing you to climax? It was starting to feel very good to you, and you were thinking about..."
"Larry and Ruth. I was thinking about that night when I woke up and they were doing it on the floor at Grandma's. I might have been moaning a little, like Ruth did. I was kind of imagining I was Ruth and that Larry was..."
"What are you saying? I'm not gay?" He gave me a speech about how homosexuality was an orientation, not a lifestyle choice, and that I should perhaps consider whether or not my being angry at Dottie or Mr. Pucci for who they were was an appropriate response. Dr. Shaw was a big perhaps man. It was one of his favorite words. "No, Dolores, your patterns as I see them show a clear attraction to men. Perhaps all that food binging you and Dottie did temporarily depressed your anger, made you numb.
And in that passive state, you... He was always doing that, too, turning his statements into little fill-in-the-blank quizzes for me. I just let her go ahead and do it? That's right. You merely gave yourself permission to dally. Yeah, but I... You what? I felt... You know. Say it. Say the word. You experienced... I don't want to say it. Why not, Dolores? Because I don't feel like saying it, okay? Aren't you always telling me to be honest about what I feel? Well, I'm just curious. I hear you using the word fuck all the time, which is an angry word when you think about it, isn't it? You usually say that word in anger. I guess I'm just wondering why fuck slips out so easily, but you can't seem to say the word orgasm. I can say it. Orgasm. There. You happy now? I am. Yes. Thank you. You're welcome. Jeez. Anyway, to get back to your question, I'd say no. Your orgasm that night doesn't make you a lesbian. Stimulation feels good, even to the clinically depressed. A finger, a tongue. Friction isn't specifically male or female. It's... Well, it's just friction. He smiled and hitched a strand of his golden hair behind his ear. But of course your sexual climax is what energized you, jolted you out of your passivity. And then you felt... Fucked over, I said. In the silence, I listened to the way I just said it as Dr. Shaw watched the discovery on my face. Fucked over, he repeated. By whom? By her, I guess. But mostly by him. Who do you mean? Eric! Who else would I mean? What right did that shithead have to make a joke out of me? I kept telling him to stop, but he... What? What is it you're thinking? Is that why I killed the fish? To get back at Eric? Is it? Yes. Yes. Of course it is. I stood up and walked to the window. Watched the distant whitecaps, the slanted icy drizzle pelt against building B. Let my tears fall. I turned back and faced him again. Could you stop saying of course after everything, please? All this is new to me. All those of courses make me feel kind of stupid. Certainly, he said. Of course. Who else fucked you over, Dolores? Over the years, I mean. Make us a list. Blood banged inside my head. You know who. Tell me. Jack Spite. He nodded solemnly. Anyone else? You name it. Kids at school, my father, my... Who were you going to say just then? Nobody. Are you sure? Positive. I'll admit this, too. Part of the reason I cooperated with Dr. Shaw at first was because I had a crush on him. On the ward after lights out, I used to visualize myself unlacing those earth shoes, unbuttoning and unzipping him. Lying in my bed, trying not to hear DiPolito's gurgly snoring, one room down, I'd conjure up his bare chest and let my fingers do the walking. They kept our rooms so hot, not humid heat, the sexy kind, but oven heat, the kind that collapses your sinuses and makes your head ache. It used to rise up at me from the register between my bed and the wall, while I lay there quietly, my fingers turning into Dr. Shaw. Friction is friction, I used to reason. What the fuck? Sometimes I could figure out what Dr. Shaw was up to and deny him. That felt good. When had men with power over me ever made my life better? Can you name one thing during that whole Cape Cod business that put you at ease? He asked me at the end of one unproductive session. We'd spent our whole hour on my suicide trip. Those lemon donuts I bought on the way, I said. They were pretty excellent. He sighed and looked up at his ceiling. This is work I thought we'd already accomplished. Where did your impulse to overeat come from? What was the pattern there? I sighed impatiently, reciting what he wanted like a bratty child. I ate because I was angry. So did eating the donuts really make you feel good? I rolled my eyes. No. Then would you please answer my question seriously? I knew what he was after. He wanted me to lift up my rotting whale to see if Ma was under it. He was always looking for Ma. What was the question again? I said. I forgot what you even asked me. I asked you to identify a moment up there on Cape Cod when you felt at ease, felt good, felt freed. Freed? The word interested me, in spite of myself. He nodded. Freed. In the water, I guess. Out in the ocean. Ah, he said. Go on. Go on what? I just like the way it felt out there. What did you like about it? He leaned closer. I could smell his Listerine. Swimming, I said. Feeling weightless. And going underwater. We're over our time, you know, in case you're interested. He reached over to his desk and turned the clock to the wall, an act that panicked me. Why did you like it underwater, Dolores? What was good about it? When what you said excited him, his hair boinged a little. How should I know? It was like you just said, it freed me or something. Dr. Shaw took both my hands in his. Let's suppose, he said, that we're at some crucial place right now, right at this second. I want you to visualize it for me. Let's say, for example's sake, that it has to do with the ocean, with swimming, with our work together. Picture it for us, Dolores. Are we about to break the surface? Crash through to the daylight? Or are we about to take the plunge, to go under and explore the depths? Which do you see us doing, right here, right now? He waited. He wouldn't look away. I figured it was safer to give him whatever answer he wasn't looking for, but I miscalculated. Thought he wanted sunlight and breakthroughs. We're going under, I said. You're sure? Yep. We're taking the plunge. He closed his eyes and smiled. Do you feel what I feel? His pleasure made me twitch. How should I know? What do you feel? That we're at the beginning of our real work together. The beginning? What's all this other stuff been? Jumping jacks? But sarcasm was a broken tool when Dr. Shaw got hopped up like that. Do you know, Dolores, why you felt the urge to swim underwater? Why that came first to mind just now when I asked about feeling good? It didn't come first. I thought about the donuts first. He looked disapproving. Well, technically, I mean. The water. Your submergence. Weren't you perhaps recreating? I shrugged. The womb? The womb? He smiled and nodded. Trying, perhaps, to re-enter the safety of your mother, to return to the warm, wet protection of the person who hadn't yet failed you.
Failed me how?
By leaving you those times she was sick, by dying.
The womb?
It was instinctive.
It was?
Primal, really. Atavistic.
He looked so satisfied with me,
Look, just leave my mother out of it, okay? Besides, it wasn't warm. It was fucking freezing. When I got out of the water, I turned blue. I was crying. It was so cold.
Exactly, he said, slapping the arm of his recliner. Why does a baby cry at birth?
Now he was up and pacing. I don't know, because the doctor smacks it.
The baby cries because of the drop in temperature. From 98.6 to room temp, a good 25 degrees colder. It's a shock. The shock of becoming. The chill of the life force. On a symbolic level, we could say you were midwifing yourself out in that water, couldn't we?
I shrugged my fake indifference. You're the boss, I said.
I'm not the boss. You're the boss. The incredible thing we just learned here is that you didn't begin your recovery here at Gracewood. You began it that morning out there in the ocean, long before I entered the picture. I'm just along with you for the ride.
For the swim, you mean?
Dr. Shaw's infrequent laughter was an alarming snort of cheer that distorted his handsome face, turned him into Francis the Talking Mule.
For the swim, he repeated, with a hearty guffaw. Yes, that's right, the swim.
Let's close now, Dolores. There are some calls I want to make. There's a doctor on the West Coast I want very much to talk to. I think we've covered some valuable ground here today. I think we've found some real direction, don't you?
Perhaps, I said.
He didn't get the joke. The next day, he told me he was going to take his cue from me and reparent me. Start from scratch, because of all the inadvertent damage my real parents had done. Together, he said, closing his eyes to visualize it, together, we're going to rewind your childhood and record over it. He was always doing that, making my life seem like electronic equipment.
Look, I told you before, whatever this has to do with my mother, I'd just as soon we keep her out of it, I said. My mother was a saint.
He cocked his head to the side slightly. A saint? One of the things I'd withheld from him was Ma's flying leg painting. That lost picture was the closest I came to believing in anything like heaven, in some kind of world that was calm and right. I didn't want him going anywhere near my mother.
She's dead, okay, I said. Just leave her alone.
In my opinion, it's a mistake to keep playing hide-and-seek with this, Dolores. It's counterproductive.
Last time you said I was the boss. What was that happy horse shit about?
He sighed and nodded. All right, he said.
All right. I'll try as best I can to respect your ground rules until you're ready to step over them yourself. Now I want you to go back to your room and relax.
Tomorrow, we're going on a rather amazing trip together.
Yeah, well, if it's Mystic Seaport again, forget it. I spent that whole last field trip bored out of my skull.
It's not the seaport, no. But it will be one of the most mystic experiences of your life. That much I promise you. Tomorrow, I become your surrogate mother. You and I are going back to the womb.
Maybe you are, I said. Send me a postcard.
He leaned toward me, close enough so that our knees touched. I know it sounds a bit unconventional, Dolores, but I spent much of yesterday afternoon on the phone with a doctor in California who's had very good results with this approach. And I've spent half this morning battling the Freudians at this staid institution to gain permission.
Well, that's not the point. The point is that I believe what I'm proposing can really help you. But if you have misgivings, if you don't trust me enough to let me take you where I think we need to go, then stop me now. Let me know right away and we'll travel a different path.
He waited, his eyes pleading in some eerily familiar way. His face looked flush with fever.
Okay, I said. Fine. Don't have a bird over it. His excitement that session, the aroma of his mouthwash, the kiss of his knees as we sat recliner to recliner, made me catch a kind of fever, too. But in the dark of my room that night, I wasn't exactly thinking of Dr. Shaw as my mother. It suddenly occurred to me why his expression, that look in his eyes, had seemed familiar. It was that same vulnerable, pleading look of Dante's in the Polaroid pictures. Another of my secrets. Dr. Shaw had spent all yesterday afternoon, half that morning, on my case. On me. I lay awake, transferring his head to Dante's body. I must have been groaning when I came, because Evelyn, the night supervisor, was there with her flashlight in my face before I was even through. "What happened?" she asked. "Oh, nothing. I just had a dream. About my mother." I smiled hard at her. Under the blanket, I was still bucking. You had to give Dr. Shaw credit for enthusiasm. The next night at the pool in Building B, he almost killed himself on my behalf. He came for me in the ward just before lights out, like it was a date. That really rattled old DePolito and drove us to the other end of the grounds. I had to unlock and open all the gymnasium doors with Dr. Shaw's keys while he lugged a big reel-to-reel tape recorder and a jumble of extension cords. He told me his plan as we sat at the pool's edge. I was going to start over pretty much as a fetus, he said, and grow up all over again, this time getting my life right. It might take 6 months. It might take 6 years. The process would be unpredictable. The rhythm would be more or less up to me. As he spoke, I dipped my finger in the water and traced my initial on the pool apron. I kept doing it. By the time he was through, all the D's I'd made had become a puddle. "Any questions?" Dr. Shaw asked. I stared at the shiny water in front of us, scared of whatever might emerge. "Nope," I said. "All right, then. Let's go." He hypnotized me first. "You are on an elevator, traveling down to the level of your subconscious," he said. "I'll call out the floors, and when I get to the basement, you'll quietly slip off your clothes and get into the water." We were somewhere around the fourth floor when I told him to hold it. "Can't we just do this with my clothes on?" I asked. At Gracewood, nakedness wasn't such a big deal. You were always seeing somebody's ugly body or vice versa. Still, parading my flab and broken capillaries in front of Dr. Shaw wasn't exactly the same as having DePolito or Mrs. Ropiek check me out. Dr. Shaw gave me one of his disappointed looks. "Do you not understand this after all we've gone over? What are you, Dolores?" "I'm a fetus." "And what's this?" His arm extended out to the pool. "The womb. And who am I?" I was too embarrassed to look him in the face. "My mother," I said. "Right. Mother, womb, fetus. Do you trust me?" I looked out at the still water. "Do you trust me?" he repeated. I nodded. "And does a fetus have an aversion to her own body? Does a fetus have any expectations whatsoever?" I shook my head. "Does a fetus wear clothes?" I shook it again. "Our elevator has reached the basement floor, an environment of trust. Take your clothes off, please." I eased bare-assed into the shallow end and waded out. The bathwater temperature matched Dr. Shaw's tone of voice. When I was over my head, I closed my eyes and began floating. It sort of half-worked for a while. I didn't seem to be in quite the same dingy pool with the missing wall tiles where they forced us to do calisthenics every Wednesday and Saturday morning. With my ears underwater, with Dr. Shaw's voice blurring away, I did mislay my expectations. Fell back. Felt fetal. It was his enthusiasm that wrecked it. "Ah, I'm quickening," he called down to me. "My baby must be testing her little arm buds." I would have preferred him to keep quiet. I was under 200 pounds by then, but not that much under. My arms were still twin hams, not little buds. "I wonder what my baby is thinking at this moment," he called, rubbing his stomach with his hands. What I was thinking about was whether or not his being my mother was going to wreck my nightly friction ritual. "There's something very special about the bond between a mother and her baby," Dr. Shaw called out over the water. All this stuff about mothers made me think suddenly of Grandma. I imagined her walking in on Dr. Shaw and me. "It's not what you think, Grandma," I'd explain. "I'm a fetus. He's Ma." I knew just how she'd react. Her jaw would unhinge itself. She'd clutch that purse of hers. Getting caught by Grandma made me slosh the water. "My baby is very active this evening," Dr. Shaw called down. "She's flailing inside me." He'd flail, too, if she was his grandmother. Now I was strictly myself again, fat Dolores floating in chlorine. "Perhaps I'll play some music to soothe my baby." That was where the tape recorder came in. I cocked my head out of the water and watched as he snaked out the extension cords, plugging one into another until the wires reached across the room to an outlet. Maybe some Dvorak, or Mozart, perhaps. Ma called this hotsy-totsy music. Her own tastes ran more to the Ink Spots and Teresa Brewer. "Music soothes the savage breast," Dr. Shaw announced, then crouched to make the last of his electrical connections. I was trying to visualize savage breasts when I both heard and saw the sizzle. Dr. Shaw was down on his knees, twitching and jerking. Then he curled up on himself and was still. I got out and ran dripping past the arc and crackle of the extension cord that had landed in the puddle I'd made on the side of the pool. If he was dead, I'd killed him. I wrapped my sweatshirt and jeans around my wrist and gave the cord a yank that sent it flying out of the socket. Then I inched over to him, still dripping, my hands clamped to the sides of my face. "Dr. Shaw! Dr. Shaw!" I turned his name into a scream. Down on all fours, I slapped his face. Hesitantly at first, more of a tap than a slap. Then harder. Then hard enough to sting, to bring him back to life. He blinked. "Are you all right?" I asked. He stared at me, as if trying to recall who I was, then reached for my hand. I hoisted him up and led him over to the cement bleachers. The pool water quivered before us. We sat holding hands, me wet and naked still. Shivering passed between us, like electricity.